You're listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. This week, we have a special Local Motion for you. We're bringing you a regional roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio's Maeve Conran. KVNF is a member of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. It's a fantastic network of community radio stations like KVNF all over the Mountain West that come together to share stories and resources. We hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. I'm Maeve Conran, the coalition's managing editor, and coming up on today's show, a renowned Native American athlete is recognized by his hometown.
This is where I grew up. This is where I learned how to walk, talk, ski.
One scientist turns to an untraditional method to raise funds for his research in the face of federal cuts.
Did get like an original email back in January 2025 saying like, oh, your research might not be funded anymore.
We'll hear about a drag club at the University of Utah that creates a safe, welcoming space for all students.
And let them know that there is spaces and there is resources available for them.
Three Colorado public radio stations take on the federal government and win their lawsuit.
I feel like it was a victory for the First Amendment.
From Rocky Mountain Community Radio, it's the Regional Roundup. But first, some news from around the region. A novel that explores hope, love, and survival in times of encroaching darkness won the 2026 Aspen Words Literary Prize. Aspen Public Radio's Regan Mertz reports.
The award is given to works of fiction that illuminate vital contemporary issues. Maria Reba's comedic novel titled Endling focused on the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. But as she was writing, she constantly asked herself, why does fiction matter right now?
Why does art matter? And I mean, I'm still grappling with the answer to that.
Reva went to Ukraine a year after Russia's invasion to see family and conduct research. And she found out that despite the war,
theaters were full of people. Sometimes the theater went underground for safety. Opera houses were full. People were going to art galleries. People were making art.
Reva says that seeing this was proof that art in many forms sustains humanity in the best and worst times. For Aspen Public Radio, I'm Regan Mertz.
The passage of a measure that overturns a mining ban in a Minnesota wilderness area is causing concern for environmentalists in this region. The Senate recently overturned a 20-year mining ban in the headwaters of the popular Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. KSJD's Gail Binkley reports now on why people in the Rocky Mountain West are concerned.
The ban was implemented in 2023 after a lengthy environmental assessment by the U.S. Forest Service. Supporters of its removal used the Congressional Review Act to undo the ban. The nonprofit conservation groups SUA and the Center for Western Priorities say Congress could use the same act to undo the recently adopted management plan for Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. Two Utah legislators have introduced a joint resolution to do just that. I'm Gail Binkley, KSJD.
Native American athlete and skiing Hall of Famer Ross Anderson has held the U.S. record in speed skiing for 20 years. Now his achievements have been officially honored by his hometown of Durango in southwest Colorado. KSUT's Adam Burke reports.
It's hard to wrap your head around just how fast Ross Anderson has traveled on skis.
He went in astonishing 154.6 miles per hour.
Yay. On Sunday, Durango Mayor Gilda Yazzie proclaimed April 19th, 2026 to be Ross Anderson Day.
The fastest skier in American history. A record that still stands.
Sunday marked the 20th anniversary of Anderson's record-setting run in the French Alps. At the time, he was a member of the U.S. ski team competing in the World Cup circuit.
When I took that run, the record run, I couldn't even hear helicopters or the crowd because I was so focused.
Anderson experienced the ski run that changed his life in vivid detail.
It's so intense going over 150 with all the wind pressure, and it just tearing you apart.
But he says in the hours and days afterward, the significance of his achievement did not immediately sink in.
It was so surreal. I was in that zone where things in front of me were slower than normal. And so when you're in that zone, you're kind of out of body. So it took me a couple months to realize I actually broke that record.
Ross Anderson's ancestry is Cheyenne, Arapaho, Chiricahua, and Mescalero Apache. But he came to Durango when he was a baby, adopted by white parents. So while he absorbed skiing at a young age, he only started connecting to Native American culture as a young adult.
I was like a sponge. I soaked everything in, learned a lot over at the Southern Ute tribe, talked to the elders over there, you know, had friends over there that had big families, and went to some of their bear dances and powwows and whatnot. And that's how I learned, really, is doing it the way I wanted to.
In the history of professional snow sports, there have been only a few Native American competitors. And Anderson is the only Native American member of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. On Sunday, Southern Ute dancers, drummers, and singers performed. A number of Anderson's childhood pals also showed up on Sunday.
Ross was always a daredevil.
Adam Smith grew up next door to Anderson.
He would ride his bike down our driveway and launch himself off the driveway into trees looking for a landing spot, go fast, take risks, be crazy. He's always been that person.
Anderson has lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico for years, but he says in some ways, Durango will always be his hometown.
This is where I grew up. This is where I learned how to walk, talk, ski, go fast, fall, fail, succeed. It feels like home to me.
For KSUT, I'm Adam Burke.
In the face of massive budget cuts across many federal agencies, scientists can no longer rely on traditional funding mechanisms to complete their research. One researcher working in our region has turned to an untraditional method. He's using crowdfunding platform GoFundMe to raise money to pay for his research. Our rural climate reporter, Caroline Yanis, has more.
Jonathan Stein is a postdoctoral geology researcher at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. For the past couple of years, he's been working in Bears Ears National Monument in southern Utah, studying a rock formation called the Cutler Group.
And these different minerals would have different, like, unique magnetic, radioactive, and chemical signatures. And by measuring these signatures using equipment at the University of Minnesota, I can then determine what the climate was like and thus answer big picture questions about how life evolved on land.
But Stein says there's contemporary applications for this research, too. He says other work has shown toxic levels of arsenic and uranium in aquifers in Bears Ears, in rock formations above the Cutler Group.
But the wide geographic spread and their association with past uranium mining really kind of stresses the need of, like, we should probably look at other aquifers to see if these toxins are present. And this, of course, has important implications for the communities in Bears Ears, specifically in the Navajo Nation, which immediately borders Bears Ears to the south.
Stein's work was primarily funded by grants from the National Science Foundation. He says postdocs are in a weird position, because even though you may be an employee of a university, you're not really faculty, and you're not a student either.
They don't have the funds to pay you, or at least they don't have anything set aside to pay you for salary. So the way they pay you is the grants that they receive.
But when Donald Trump took office in 2025, there were massive budget and staffing cuts at NSF, thanks to Elon Musk's DOGE task force.
People get emails saying, like, your funding just doesn't exist anymore. And I did get, like, an original email back in January 2025 saying, like, oh, your research might not be funded anymore.
DOGE and the Trump administration targeted research topics they didn't find politically acceptable.
Such as, like, environmental work, anything that said the word diversity in it, even if it said something like biodiversity or anything related to climate, like my research studies ancient climate.
Stein thinks that in the past, the EPA may have been interested in his work for the public health impacts, but
they ended their grant program entirely. You can go on the EPA website, like I just checked this morning. You can click like research funding opportunities. When you click it, it just says there are no research funding opportunities this time. And it's been that way since January 2025.
So Stein made the decision to make a GoFundMe page to raise money for things like lab costs to analyze the rock samples, as well as his living expenses. The main reason for crowdfunding?
One, my desperation.
Stein has been moderately successful. He's raised over $4,000 since he started the fundraiser 7 months ago, but his ultimate goal is $10,000. Some people have been able to raise even more for research. Stein pointed to a friend at an Ivy League school who had been able to crowdsource over $20,000 in a few months, but they also had tens of thousands of followers on social media.
And a lot of scientists, including myself, we just don't have that kind of outreach, you know?
There is support out there for scientists who are looking to get into crowdfunding. Stein says he got help from a platform called Researcher with creating content to post on his social media promoting the campaign, and they feature scientists on their website who are crowdfunding. But he's skeptical that it's going to work as a widespread approach for scientists because of how time-consuming and difficult crowdfunding is.
So, I mean, unless they're in particularly desperate situations like I am, you might not see a lot of people rising from it. I think most people will probably just try to wait to see if the tides shift and federal funding might return.
Stein is hoping that he can raise enough money to complete a final data set, which he wants to use as a stepping stone to do even further research and more grant opportunities for his work in bear's ears.
Mostly because I do think, especially if this toxin, the screening for toxin element of it, to potentially see if there's uranium and arsenic in these water-bearing rocks, I think has a lot of societal importance.
He'd love for his success to eventually translate into a permanent faculty position at a university. But Stein warns that for many people in his position, the outlook is grim.
You know, a lot of those headlines that say like, oh, we're going to lose a whole generation of scientists, and it's true.
In the coming months, Congress will decide whether it will accept the Trump administration's current proposal to cut millions of dollars from NSF and other federal research grant programs. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, I'm Caroline Yanez.
You are listening to the Regional Roundup from Rocky Mountain Community Radio. I'm Maeve Conran. The Drag Club at the University of Utah creates a safe space for students interested in drag culture. This is despite the fact that the state of Utah has passed a slew of anti-LGBTQ and anti-DEI legislation in recent years. A student reporter at KRCL in Salt Lake City took a look at the drag club, and he, along with one of the drag club members, joined Laura Jones, the host of Radioactive, in the KRCL studio.
Time to talk with some of our Voices of Utah student reporters. It's a class that we do with Professor Marcy Uncancio of Amplify Utah. Let's pass the mic and find out more.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Gabardi. I'm a Voices of Utah student journalist at the University of Utah.
Hi, I'm Veronica Takanaka, and I am a student at the U of U and the president of the U of U Drag Club.
What attracted you to this story in the Arts and Culture beat, Gabe?
So I think this semester in our beat in Arts and Culture was really about expanding your mind and entering spaces that you are both unfamiliar with and uncomfortable with.
Okay.
And doing things that you have not a lot of knowledge about. So this was an art form that I did not have a lot of information about and a lot of exposure to. So for me, this was about expanding my horizons and trying something new and learning about a community and an art form that is so cool.
Veronica, tell us about starting the drag club and a little bit about your origin story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually started the U of U Drag Club my freshman year, which was 2024 when I came into the U of U. I actually started it with two alumni now. They have since graduated. We miss them very much. But they actually kind of came to me and they were like, hey, like, we've been performing in drag. We know that you have kind of been active in the drag scene. We've been looking for a third officer and we were wondering if you would like to participate. And then ever since then, they've graduated and I've kind of taken the reins a little bit in terms of like what the drag club looks like, what we're doing. And yeah, now we're just kind of a small little group who just loves to congregate up at the U and just have a great time. Yeah.
Well, this is also at the same time that universities have been told to cut that out when it comes to DEI, and right. that includes the LGBTQ community.
Yeah. I think we are very lucky in the way that I think because our name is the U of U Drag Club, and it's not inherently anything that's super DEI or anything, something that's inherently LGBTQ+, mm-hmm. I think we're safe in that aspect, which is we have a very lucky case scenario. I am so grateful that we are able to still continue to function up at the U, especially with all of these anti-DEI bills that are being passed. But yeah, it's been an awesome time, and I'm just so grateful.
Now, tell us about your story, and you dig into it and you find out some more things that you want the community to know about, Gabe.
So one of the first things that Veronica shared with me was that this club was actually a little bit in response to HB 261 in 2024, which was the anti-DEI bill. So the goal with this story was to really send out a line to queer students at the University of Utah and let them know that there is spaces and there is resources available for them. And this was kind of a look inside of mm-hmm. what that looks like and kind of access how they can get involved and what it looks like to have these designated spaces at the university.
You also said you were interested in learning and writing about things that you didn't know much about or were uncomfortable with. How are you now?
Now I think I could name everything that there is to need to know about drag. I feel so much more qualified to talk about the art form.
Are you comfortable?
I'm extremely comfortable. I've gotten to know a lot of the history and where it actually comes from. Veronica told me a lot about Marsha P. Johnson and mm-hmm. the work that she did in her time.
You're the first brick or the one that's known for kicking off Stonewall, mm-hmm. right?
Yep, that's her.
So all of these significant events throughout history that have led to the current, how we perceive drag currently, and kind of its 2026 modern day evolution of drag. Mm-hmm. I've learned about, where that comes from and kind of the process of it coming to what it is today.
Yeah. So Veronica, you're also a trans woman on campus, I understand. Mm. And that is that harder in the last couple of years, given national and state politics?
Yeah. It has definitely been a very big challenge in terms of me being able to express myself openly on campus. I feel like I am very lucky in a case where I feel like I pass very well in a very heteronormative society. And I feel like I have a lot of privilege that comes with that in terms of being able to kind of fit into what people perceive as a cis person, even though that's not how I identify. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen, especially for a lot of the drag club members who are also trans, they also have a lot of similar issues of not being able to fully express themselves or be open about their identity on campus just for the sake of trying to keep their safety and their peace. And especially when, once again, these anti-DEI bills keep on being brought up and all of these bills that are being passed that are specifically targeting trans people. It is so hard to just live authentically. But the thing that we kind of try and focus on in drag club is that we need to do it and we need to mm-hmm. keep on showing up and protesting.
And that is rising journalist Gabe Gabardi and Veronica Takanaka of the Drag Club at the University of Utah.
Thanks to KRCL's Laura Jones for that report. In March, a federal judge ruled that President Trump violated free speech with an executive order he issued in May 2025 to defund NPR and PBS. Trump claimed the news outlets were biased and directed all federal agencies to stop funding the organizations. NPR and three Colorado stations, including our partners in Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Aspen Public Radio and KSUT, argued in a lawsuit that the order violated their First Amendment rights. To find out more about the suit, KDNK's Lily Jones spoke with Breeze Richardson, the executive director of Aspen Public Radio.
For our listeners who are unfamiliar, can you take us a little bit more in depth on that executive order and what it entailed?
President Trump issued this executive order that prohibited any federal funds from going to NPR or PBS. And what I think a lot of the conversation that ensued following that executive order was that most of the funds that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting distributed didn't go directly to NPR or PBS. They went to local stations. And we would use that funding to, in turn, purchase programming from NPR, whether that was Morning Edition and All Things Considered or shows like Here and Now. And so that prohibition, which extended to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but really any federal agency that was granting funds to public media, this mostly applied to the Department of Education and the National Endowment for the Arts, that was now an illegal action. And so the plaintiffs, which include Aspen Public Radio, KSUT Public Radio, which is down in Ignacio, Colorado, and Colorado Public Radio, joined with NPR in this lawsuit to challenge that executive order, which has now been deemed illegal. So clarity has been given to the federal agencies that they are not violating this executive order if they pass federal funds through to NPR or PBS.
Okay, that's awesome. And can you explain maybe in simpler terms, why did the judge rule that executive order illegal? And it was just parts of that executive order, right?
Right. And so at the root of the decision from Judge Moss is that funding cannot be used to control speech. So saying to NPR, you're reporting, I don't like your reporting, and so you shouldn't be eligible to get this money because I don't like what you're saying, violates the First Amendment. It violates freedom of the press. And in our case, it violates freedom of association because it's saying I can't buy NPR programming as a local station. I can't associate with them. And that's prohibited by the First Amendment of our Constitution. Now, what this federal order did not do was restore our funding. So while the executive order was deemed illegal, it did not, what the judge ruled did not undo what Congress did. So the executive order was issued in May, and it was in July that Congress voted to rescind federal funding. And so a judge's ruling can't undo that congressional act, but it can open the door for possible funding in the future, which would have been a challenging thing for us to pursue with that executive order still in place.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about what it was like for you as the president of RMCR and the executive director of Aspen Public Radio to decide that you wanted to join in on this lawsuit and kind of take us through what it was like for you from the beginning to bringing home this giant win?
Yeah. So we were approached by NPR about joining the lawsuit. And at the time, due to privacy reasons, we weren't allowed to know who else was being approached. So it wasn't until after I had gone through the decision making to join the lawsuit, which I involved our board of directors, because, of course, they're the governing body for the community held license that Aspen Public Radio operates. And the board unanimously voted to proceed with joining the lawsuit. It was only then that I learned who the other plaintiffs were, and we were in a position to talk a little bit more about our legal strategy. And for a whole host of reasons, NPR and their legal counsel had approached our three stations because in a lot of ways, Colorado's a little microcosm to what public radio looks like nationwide, you know, with Colorado Public Radio being the statewide entity, the way they approach programming and the range of counties and communities that they serve looks different than what KSUT Public Radio down in Ignacio, who in part serves the Southern Ute tribe. And the history of that station is really rooted in the tribe. And so they provide access to information and news in that tribal community in a way that unfortunately looks a lot like Indian country, but doesn't necessarily look like the rest of the country as far as broadband access and just access to information in general. And then Aspen Public Radio, which is a rural mountain community that feels really strongly about having access to news and information, but at the end of the day is really small. You know, we have less than 10 employees. I come from WBEZ in Chicago, where there's over 140 employees, and we do the same thing. We provide a service 24/7, and we do it with 10, and they do it with 140. So, you know, that reality of kind of where we get our programming and how we make our decisions, you know, we really felt like we were in a position to take one for the team. So it goes. I knew this community was going to support me and support the station in taking this action, and that not every radio station in the country had that luxury. Some are university licensees where getting involved in a legal battle would be much more complicated because of university rules. Some are state agencies by default because of how their governance structure is set up. And so there were a lot of factors that kind of went into why these three Colorado stations would be best positioned to do this. But it's been a long 10 months, but it's also been, you know, really exciting. The three leaders went to Washington in December and were in the courtroom for our hearing. And just participating in this whole process has been really amazing.
What was it like in court? Did you feel intimidated? Did you feel empowered?
I think it's fair to say we felt empowered. We didn't have any speaking role, but our lawyer, who is the incredible Steve Zansberg, actually last year he was inducted into the Colorado Press Association Hall of Fame for all the First Amendment work he has done defending the press here in Colorado. And he took our case pro bono. So all of the work he did and support of the three Colorado plaintiffs was something he did because he really believed in the case. And being with him and having him take that podium and defend us, he made a point to show the judge that we were in the courtroom. And the judge definitely reacted to that and took note of the fact that we had flown there to be in the room. The drama of the courtroom was like, as you expected, and not at the same time. Little things like our legal team was fierce. I mean, there's pictures of us like walking into the courtroom and there's this big wooden table, or two of them, like one for the prosecution and one for the defense. And our table was just like had all these people around it and then like all these support people around it. And I don't know what it is with three-ring binders and lawyers, but there was like a million three-ring binders on the table and they're like writing notes to each other. And I mean, we just really looked prepared for the case. And then you looked over to the government side and there were these like three seemingly junior attorneys and there was no three-ring binders. And they were literally like taking notes on a Post-it notes. And it just looked like there was a stark difference between the two and maybe the seriousness with which we were approaching the case. And then even in their like defense, it just didn't really feel like the case was very thought out or put together. Or so there was kind of almost a disappointment in that it just didn't seem like it was nearly as serious to the government as it was to us. And so I think there was a little bit of disheartened reality there that, like you said, before we started talking, I mean, there's been so many executive orders and such a delay in the courts deeming them illegal, whether that's tariffs or retaliation against lawyers or our case, that I think it's been really hard for the general American public to keep up with what's happening, what the impacts of those decisions are. Even this morning on the news, we were talking about tariffs and what the state of Colorado has estimated we've lost or, you know, paid. And now that that's been deemed illegal, I'm going to try to figure out how to get back. It's just really complicated and messy. And I think personally, part of this administration's goal is to overwhelm and make an everyday American feel like this is too complicated and it's not worth paying attention to. And that's exactly why we took up the case and said, no, like we have to have access to news information. We have to have journalists and journalism that helps explain and keep us informed about what our government's doing. And so I feel like it was a victory for the First Amendment more than it was a victory for us as a station or as a newsroom.
KDNK's Lily Jones was speaking with Aspen Public Radio's Executive Director, Breeze Richardson. And Breeze is also the chair of the Board of Directors of Rocky Mountain Community Radio. You've been listening to the Regional Roundup, a production of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a network of public and community radio stations in Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, including this one. Thanks to KSJD's Gail Binkley, Aspen Public Radio's Reagan Mertz, KSUT's Adam Burke, our rural climate reporter Caroline Yonas, KRCL's Laura Jones, and KDNK's Lily Jones for today's show. Our theme music is Take Me Somewhere by Joel Adam Russell. I'm Maeve Conran. Thanks for listening.
This has been Locomotion on KVNF. I'm Brody Wilson. Thanks so much for listening. Locomotion airs every Tuesday at 5 p.m. and Saturday at 10 a.m. If you ever miss a Locomotion on air that you want to hear, you can always find past episodes by looking under the news tab at kvnf.org and looking for Locomotion. Thanks so much for listening.